The Unconventional Therapist's Guide to Nothing.
Hey everybody, this is The Unconventional Therapist, and I am Dave, and I'm joined here with my co-host, Greg. Greg, how are you today?
Dave, I'm doing great. And I, you know, just to give the people a glimpse into a little small talk we're having about various books we're reading.
Yes.
And I'm thinking to myself, as you mentioned Dune, that if people want to catch a glimpse of what the essence of what Dave looks like, his prowess, think of a manly Chamolet.
An old.
Oh, you put in the old. I didn't say
I
that.
I did. I'm filled with gray
beautiful
beard
curly
hair.
Locks with more of a manly presence and also a tender heart, which we hear about every day here.
He is very skinny.
Yeah. I mean, not that we're shaming.
No. It's just like he is like really, really skinny. I like sometimes we'll catch like the little reels on Instagram and, you know, of him doing all of his when he was doing the Willy Wonka stuff. And he's wearing like this like skin tight clothing and he's like so small. It's like,
yeah, a lot of skin tight Chamolet in your algorithm, huh, Dave? I don't know what that's about.
Or Willy Wonka stuff, I guess. Okay. How can we go that direction?
Yeah, no, you're right. I probably get a lot of Willy Wonka too. Very a huge fan of that. I'm more of a Gene Wilder guy. Of course. I don't know where we're going. Hey, listen.
Yes, Greg. Go ahead.
Get us back on track. Should we get
all
us?
Right. You know, as we'll do from time to time, most of our episodes are, what would you say, Greg? Timeless, I think you called us once.
Yeah.
We tried not to throw in too many, like, super relevant, like, on this date kind of references. But every now and then, it does sneak into the podcast. And I did want to just do one today, really quick. Because both Greg and I did receive some really, really sad news today, which... You know, we're going to do our best to cover this topic and obviously, you know, present as we normally try to present. But I know there is something really heavy on the back of both of our minds as we both have lost a supervisor, a colleague, dare I say a visionary.
I mean, even like a mentor or like someone who is handling the behind the scenes where we didn't have to. All we have to worry about is doing our thing as therapists. And this person took care of the rest.
Yes. So Bob Aruda is somebody who was, basically he owns the practice that we practice at, and he passed away, unfortunately, this weekend. And hearing that was shocking because it was unexpected, especially on our ends, because, you know, I didn't know all the details of everything. But I was thinking about it and I was like, wow. What a legacy to leave behind. You know, he knew so many people. He was connected to so many people, but in a way that was like respected and respectable. Mm-hmm. And his vision for our practice in particular was to cover as much ground in Rhode Island as possible. And I kind of chuckle as I say it because Rhode Island's a rather small state. So that probably doesn't, but that's a hard thing because Rhode Island is all about who you know, who you're connected to. So in order to do that for some people, it's almost like it would be impossible for me to get connected because I know nobody, right? But he knew so many people and he had touched so many people's lives and his vision of how you handle business and how you grow your business was all about the way you treat people. And I think that was such like, that was something that I really took to heart. Like you can run a business and not be this like dictator or like, you know, not, you know, run over people or take people for granted. He was all about treating us providers with respect, dignity, and, you know, understanding that without the providers that are going to be in his practice, there is no practice.
Right.
It's also sad that that said a lot.
You, Bob, and myself all had some goals and some plans for the future, working with first responders and getting that going. And sadly, that's cut short. And, you know, with his life, it's just hard to think about how many lives are going to be touched and how much potential there was for good work to get done. And it's really a really sad day. But I think, and you know, we have an ironic sort of episode today, which we had not planned. So we mean no, I don't know, proceeds.
Yeah, no, I felt a little bit like, wow, the title, the theme of our topic this week really doesn't feel great. But obviously we spent the entire week researching it. And then the day of, we learned this news. So it's like, really don't have anything else I can talk about other than this topic after researching it for the, you know, for the time we did. So we're obviously going to continue with the topic, but I just, you know, kind of wanted to share that information and just, you know, say that our thoughts are obviously with his wife and his daughter and his family and the rest of our practice, who pretty much is his family and or close friends or, you know, just, yeah. So with that being said, I will switch gears a little bit. And Greg, I guess I will, I'm sorry to kind of set you up on this note, but I guess I'll ask you to kind of give us an overview of what the topic is this week.
Sure, Dave. All right. So most religions, and even, as you know, my love, timeless literature, address a specific topic that we really love to know about or need to know about. So if you think of Homer, you think of Dante, the major religions, they all attempt to answer the question. And the question is, what happens when we die? Is there an afterlife? Some of us claim to say, you know, of course there is. Of course there is. And how do they know that? Because they say they've been there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So today what we're going to talk about is near-death experiences.
So Greg, I think an interesting starting point for this would be, before we even get into it, have you ever had a near-death experience?
Well, no, I haven't. But
how can you even do a podcast on this? Oh, what? No. You fraud, you phony.
Yeah. But Dave, have you?
No.
Oh, okay. Two people in my family have.
Oh, so you're like living vicariously through them today?
Yeah. I don't know if you want me to get into it. I can probably get into it later, but should I?
When were you planning on getting into it?
Later, I think.
Let's do it now then.
Okay.
Just to screw up your, no, I'm just kidding.
So Dave, let me first kind of explain. It's sort of simple what this is, but.
Are you going to mansplain it to me?
I'm going to mansplain it to you.
All right. Thank you.
So Dave, pay attention. I'm going to need to pay attention, right?
Just make sure you use words I understand, Greg.
So you've got to be so physically damaged. I don't. That's the best kind of combination of words I can come
up
with.
Story of my life.
Right. You've got to be near death. Let's just put it that way, right? Okay. And here's something interesting about this. When you're near death, let's say your heart stops. A lot of the times this happens, your heart stops. You literally die, right?
Okay, yeah.
So 20 seconds after your heart stops, you lose all brain activity.
20 seconds?
20 seconds. So how do we have these chronological narratives? It's not dreaming, because we know what dreaming is like. If you want to learn about dreaming, we got a whole episode on that. It's more vivid and you have control. So your brain's down, right? So we're saying you literally die.
Yeah.
You have some kind of religious or spiritual experience we'll talk about. And then you're brought back to life and you're able to tell about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Like, that's essentially what it is.
You know, is that kind of like when you don't they say like if a chicken gets head cut off, it still like can see things for a little while?
No, how would anybody ever know that?
That's
been my problem. Do they interview
the body
chicken?
Moves around, so they assume that the head's also working.
They came in for a quick interview with the chicken. Mm-hmm. No, see, yeah, and people think that you're not alive. Once your heart, your brain stops functioning. And so if your brain's not functioning, here's one thing. Your brain's not functioning, so you're thinking without your brain and you're in some kind of altered state. Yeah. That's a strange thing to say, thinking without your brain.
All right, hear me out.
Okay.
You ever been put to sleep?
Yeah. Yep.
Is it kind of like that?
It's not. And we're going to talk about what it's also not as time goes on. Like, it's not a psychedelic. It's not a hallucinogen.
It could be because of the psychedelics.
Like a bad reaction, you mean?
Not psychedelics, maybe, but like it could be because of chemicals put in your body or like medicines.
Yeah, you're talking about dying?
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways that you can die, Dave. We don't have to probably name them all, but
okay.
I mean, there's a lot of things that could go wrong and you can end up in one of these situations. Mm-hmm. But I want to lay out to you, because I don't think you're getting the whole spectrum of what's going on here. And I It's the components. There's components of this. And the first one you've definitely heard of. And maybe this is the most credible part of the story. This is what makes it or sort of real in my mind. So there's an out-of-body experience. And that's when you've seen on Unsolved Mysteries or different shows where you kind of come out of your body and you see the doctors working on you. And what's interesting about this is when they interview people, there's a guy called Jeffrey Long, I might have mentioned him already, but he's gotten like 4,000 or 5,000 cases. And he's a medical doctor and he does this as sort of a hobby. And he says that all these instances seem to be very accurate. Like even from different accounts, like what the doctors are wearing, what they were talking about, the person comes back and talks about that. And Dave, before you're looking very skeptical, I want to tell you.
I was just thinking about something.
Okay. I want to tell you something. Explain this, because I know you're going to be the one that's saying you're going to have all kinds of reasons why this isn't some kind of spiritual event. But there was this blind woman who got into a car accident.
Yeah.
She wasn't driving.
Oh, go ahead.
Right. And she had an out-of-body experience and she saw and was able to describe what was going on. Now, what's interesting about that is she wasn't really sure what she was. She didn't know what vision was. So somehow she's able to see and describe what's in the room when she comes back too, and she's blind again. But like, how do you explain that? That's interesting.
I don't know, Greg. Sounds bonkers.
It is bonkers, and that's what's part of this. That's the
what's the name of that doctor again?
Jeffrey Long.
I was thinking about like when he was a kid, and if he ever had to go through a roll call, that's kind of
yeah.
Yep. Long Jeffrey.
Yeah. Yep. Better than short.
I just couldn't get that out of my head.
Yeah. So listen, accurate visual perception. So you're seeing things. That's part. That has to be part of.
So she was like, I saw this metal thing. How do you know what metal is? I don't know.
Dave, I know.
And it had wheels. How do you know what a wheel is?
You have to be open to the experience. So she was having a hard time describing it. And it's interesting because...
Can you think about describing anything that you've never actually seen before?
I know.
Like I mean, but I guess we're acting like this is a person who didn't exist in society and would have no idea what a thing is. But
yeah, she's not the seagull from The Little Mermaid, like combing her hair with a
fork. Yeah, I know. I don't know why I immediately went to like a place where maybe she had never had a frame of reference of anything in the world.
There was people. How do you know what people are? Well, I'm a person.
So this sounds suspicious.
Yeah. Who's to add on to that. So another part of this is accuracy with auditory perception. So hearing what's in the room, she can definitely do that, right? This feeling of peace and painlessness. You've been hurt. Yeah. You're physically damaged, as I said.
I heard stories about that. Like this person's in the, they're whatever.
Mm.
Flatlined, I guess. Is that what you want to call it?
That's what you want to call it.
Like the doctor went in and the person like the next day was conscious and able to tell the doctor, oh, I remember you from yesterday. He's like, how do you remember me? And she like was able to describe what he wore and stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also this sense
not
of
what he calm. Wore.
I will.
She was eyes closed. Not what he wore. Probably how he was presenting or something, what he said or something.
So the sense of calm, Dave, that's a hugely important thing when you're dead and you should be really anxious, but for whatever reason, you're really calm. So my sister, I can tell this quick story right now. She was on Block Island. That's, you know what that is, right off of Rhode Island. And she was swimming around, standing in the water, and her leg, you know how like the sand shifts and then your legs can kind of get stuck?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a huge wave came and knocked her back, broke her leg, and her feet were stuck in the water, and she was under, she couldn't get up. Her feet were in the sand and she was laid on her back, and the waves just rushing and rushing and rushing. And she was so panicked, and she describes this, and she says at one point, and you can, next Christmas, you should ask her. At one point she describes saying like, I almost felt calm. Like it was just over. I knew I wasn't going to be able to get up, and I was just calm, and she could see the sun through the water, and it was getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And then people picked her up out of the water and dragged her out. So is that a near-death experience? I don't know. But the light phenomena, this experience with encountering like a warm, soothing light, that's a part of it. That's a part of it. There's almost universal aspects to this.
So it sounds like there's two things going on here, Greg.
Okay.
There's a near-death experience, which is you're actually like your perception is I'm about to pass away.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't actually, but you have like the panic, which then eventually fades to a sense of calm.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the actual, like, I died for a minute and was resuscitated, and now I'm able to tell you what I saw. Those sound like two different things that are present within near-death experiences, aka NDEs.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because I think that you get to a certain point, maybe those are the early stages of an NDE, and then as we go on, maybe this is the next things I'm starting to talk about as far as the components are, maybe if you actually do, your heart does stop. And let's talk about some of those things. So you've heard of your life in review, like your whole life flashing before your eyes.
Yep.
That's always part of it. Well, not always. That doesn't happen all the time, but that's an important component. Being in another world, people all sort of describe that they've left this realm. They've, after their out-of-body experience, they encounter other beings. Now, whether that's relatives, God, some people have literally said that they met God, old family members, pets, just in not having, and the other part about it is it's like you're not talking the way we talk, and you're not seeing the way we see. You're just understanding things. Like you're in someone's presence and they're not telling you everything. They're not revealing everything, that they're not explaining the whole situation. It's just you see them and you know. That's what people are describing.
So it's a sense of having unlimited knowledge.
Yeah. That sounds like heavenly or like annoying too.
You know? How about a preview of future events yet to come?
So precognition is, I think, what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
And I'll tell you this.
Like that was, like, I sounded better when I said it.
Yeah.
I chose cooler words.
Here's the thing about that. Even in dreams, when you go to bed at tonight, 17 to 38% of people have experienced precognition in just a dream. So, yeah, you're right. Seeing the future, things that haven't happened yet, obviously it's the future, becoming aware of all of them, and it's just, that is sort of an unexplainable thing. Where's that information coming from? And that's a hugely important component of this. And another thing that I forgot that's important about this is the tunnel experience, right? Yeah. Like going
through. You did not tell us that.
The rushing through the tunnel. Now, what is that tunnel? That's how you transport to.
It's the scope of our eyes.
The other world. That's what you
think. Like our peripheral vision, like starts to hone in, and like we lose a peripheral and just see.
So you're thinking in terms of
tunnel vision.
Yeah. So you're keeping it really scientific so far. Okay.
What do you mean? I'm just saying.
Dave, don't you want to believe that there's something? All right. How about this? Can I ask you a question?
Was this X-Files?
Yeah. Well, kind of. You know, most of the time, yeah.
We're on to believe.
We are on the fringes. So do you fear death?
The reason why I don't fear death is because I have not had a near-death experience.
Well, see, I think that the opposite should be true. So you're
not to some people.
So for the people listening, ask yourself if you fear death. And if you're saying yes, then you can't really be an atheist. You have to sort of subscribe to something spiritual. And the reason why I say that is, do you fear what it was like before you were born? No, because that's nothingness. So if you believe that nothing happens when you die, how can you fear that? In order to fear something, you have to believe that something's going to happen when you die. Yeah. And I think that more of us are into spirituality more than we think. Because I think 99% of us fear death because it's the unknown. And for something to be unknown, you have to be unsure of what happens when you die. And to be unsure of what happens when you die, you have to be accepting that there's a potential of a spiritual world.
All right.
Okay.
Now, I understand that. So the question of whether you fear it or not, mm-hmm, is an interesting thought. Because like I thought about that question like right after you said it. I was like, well, it's not that I fear dying. I don't want to die in a way that feels like it would not be comfortable.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
You fear pain.
I don't want to yeah, I honestly, I don't necessarily want to go in a way that looks painful, in a way that involves any of my thousands of fears. And like, I'm just good with those things. I don't want to do those things. Any other way? Okay. I don't feel super scared about them, but they're also not scary ways to go. So.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, the fear is, what am I, am I leaving behind a mess for other people? Like, I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like, I want to make sure everything's cleaned up before I go. And hopefully that's not for a really, really long time. But I do fear, I do fear what happens after I die, because I'm not sure, have I earned a place somewhere? Is that even a thing?
You know, I've been having this conversation a lot lately about blind faith.
Okay.
Have I talked to you about it?
No.
So in order, like, there's this idea of blind faith in like religion, I think. In order to like 100% believe in any sort of like religion, you know, it involves like this higher being, whatever denomination that is, you have to have blind faith.
Yeah.
Because there's no visible or tangible proof, right? We have documents that are clearly written by, you know, man. How can you prove to me that God exists, that, you know, anything exists that's within those realms? How do you prove that to me, Greg? I'm asking you.
I don't think you can prove
blind faith. I'd have to have blind faith in order to truly believe it, right?
Even Mother Teresa couldn't have blind faith.
Yes, we did talk about it a little bit recently.
Yeah.
So when it comes to that idea of death and what comes next, in order to truly not feel afraid, right, you'd have to have just genuine blind faith. So the fact that we have some fear means we struggle with blind faith, don't we?
We have to.
Do we have to?
Well, I mean, is
I wish I could have blind faith, because then I would not be afraid at all, right?
There's no such thing as a sure thing. I think that in order to have faith, choosing to have faith requires doubt. Just like choosing to be good requires the capacity for evil. I think if anybody says they have blind faith, they're lying. And the only reason why they would, you know, you have to have an intellectual deficit, I think, to have blind faith.
You know who had blind faith, Greg?
Oh, Moses.
Moses, yes.
Did he though?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
It sounds good though.
But I'm glad that you're talking about this religious
about thing. Moses.
Moses for sure would be someone you meet in heaven, almost immediately, with all his rules. He's the bummer in heaven.
Like,
he's the
police. Oh boy, this he's the sheriff. Here.
Yeah. So that's how heaven's set up. But I look, honestly, 99% of NDEs or near-death experiences end in some sort of celestial experience where it's like, oh, here, this is the calming, happy place. This is the heaven that we all kind of understand as a part of our culture, right? Or maybe it's all cultures. But there's also a part of culture that understands another possibility. And Dave, being Dave, I think might take us down a couple of those roads where you don't always go to heaven, do you?
No, some people don't.
Some people don't. Can you give us some examples?
Let me do that. I'll do that, and then I want to get into something else after. So there's another kind of NDE that is not euphoric, that is not all that calm, and it is called distressing NDE. And okay. Boy, does this not sound fun. So it's got a totally different emotional tone than like the other NDEs, and it can range from like fear to terror to sometimes like guilt and despair. There's the thing that makes this kind of distressing NDE difficult to like fully know how often it happens is it's like a lot of times met with a reluctance to actually report it. So right now, I think they say like 1 in 5 of the near-death experiences is a distressing one, but that's, you know, could be totally just, you know, underreported. Here's another interesting thing. And this is actually kind of interesting for the thing we're talking about with like religion and spirituality and kind of like what we would take away from NDEs. There's been some decade-long clinical studies regarding them, and there's very little evidence that actually explains or predicts what type of near-death experience you're going to have, which makes me terrified to have a near-death experience if I can't predict that I'm going to have like a good or a bad one.
Well, hold on. Really, so they don't have it. So the type of near-death experience you have doesn't have anything to do with the sort of life you've been living?
No. And that's what's crazy. So there's no evidence that supports that good people have pleasant near-death experiences and that bad people have distressing ones. Saints have reported having extremely disturbing near-death experiences, and felons have encountered blissful ones. So that, take that philosophy and throw it out the window, because that would be most people's, you know, basic assumption. The life you live will kind of, you know, predict possibly or play a role in the type of near-death experience you're going to have. So there are, do you have a thought about that? That you want to
show? Well, I mean, it's just, I'm just thinking like that's what the Puritans thought. Like, even if you were good your whole life, there's still a chance you go to hell. I don't know if I love that approach.
So there's three types of distressing near-death experiences. The first one's called inverse, which is the perception. Let me think how to describe this one. The person basically perceives that event as hostile or threatening. So it's also, this one is more, to me, it's more about interpretation.
Okay.
So like someone could experience this exact same thing and be like, that was calm and peaceful. Another person could be like, no, I did not like that. That felt lonely and
like bright lights, maybe for like Gizmo.
So I have a few examples. So there's a man who's panic stricken due to feeling he was outside of his own body. So some people might find that to be like, wow, this is, what an experience. He was like, no, put me back in. What am I doing here? And then he's watching the medical technicians, kind of like this, the blind woman you described, being able to see the event. He's watching them, the medical technicians. He's like, up in this tree, and nobody hears him. And to him, that was just the worst experience. And then he's brought to a bright light. Well, same thing as most people, but he's like having the worst time seeing all this, flashing past shadowy people that seem to be deceased family members waiting for him. He did not like this, and this sat with him for years. There's a woman in childbirth. There, a lot of recollections happened during that experience. A woman in childbirth felt her spirit separate from her body. She flew into space at tremendous speed and then saw a small ball of light rushing at her. And she just was like terrified by this whole experience. And then the last example is a quick one. A woman collapsed from hypothermia and began re-experiencing her entire life. And she was filled with sadness and experienced a great deal of depression from this.
Wow. This is actually really interesting. I've never really thought about it in terms of this classic experience being horrifying.
Yeah,
but there's some truth in that, right? I'm floating above my body.
This one is interesting because this is literally all things that, like, vice versa. We've heard stories of people saying how euphoric or how, like, I'm okay, I'm ready to go. These people clearly weren't ready to go. And this experience of dying, to me, that's my interpretation of inverse NDE. I think the idea of dying just was not, they were not okay with it. They never got to that acceptance piece versus other stories we've heard where it sounds like they understood what was happening. These people were confused.
Yeah.
Like, why am I shadow family here? Like, no, I'm not ready. That was not a good experience for them. Then on to subcategory number two. Okay. This one's an interesting one, and I feel like this would be me. It's called the void near-death experiences. So there's an encounter with a perceived vast emptiness, and often a devastating scenario of aloneness, isolations, and sometimes annihilation. So an example of this is a woman in childbirth felt herself flying over the hospital and into deep, empty space. A group of circular entities informed her she never existed and her life was but a joke, and that she was not real. She argued this with facts about her life and was met with that none of those events had been real and this is all there ever was, and she was alone and left in space.
That's a nightmare.
That is awful.
Just being afraid of heights, I'm flying over the hospital, I'm already done.
You're in the afterlife and you're getting pranked. Like, come on. Here's another example. Another woman in childbirth felt herself floating on water, but eventually it was not peaceful and became pure hell. She began screaming, but no sound was coming out and it felt like a nightmare. She realized that this was eternity and that this is what was forever going to be. She felt aloneness, the emptiness of space, and the vastness of the universe.
Okay,
which
so
all could be super peaceful.
Right.
You didn't have the panic episode and then like you're screaming and nothing's coming out. Like there's something about a lack of acceptance that's happening in all these, right?
Yeah. And I think that so far I'm okay with the idea that these people didn't lead terrible lives. Now, do you have anything that sort of represents the end of the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze, where all the, like the devils are trying to pull someone down into hell?
All right. Wow. So that's the last category.
Oh boy.
Hellish near-death experience.
Okay.
So those are overtly hellish experiences. These are the least common type of distressing NDEs. An example is a man in heart failure felt himself falling into the depths of the earth. At the bottom was a set of high rusty gates, which he perceived to be the gates of hell. But luckily he managed to scramble back up to daylight. So he just saw it and got out of there, luckily. Here's another one. A woman was being escorted through a frighteningly desolate landscape and saw a group of wandering spirits. They looked lost and in pain. Her guide indicated that she was not allowed to help them. So that's actually not that hellish.
Guide. That's interesting. We haven't heard that.
Yeah, she had a guide. Kind of like, did you see the house? Oh, yeah, which I was just going to reference that movie in the last couple of years, The House That Jack Built. And he's being guided into the pits of hell, like Dante. An atheist university professor with intestinal rupture experienced being maliciously pinched, then torn apart by malevolent beings. A woman who hemorrhaged from a ruptured fallopian tube reported a near-death experience involving horrific beings with gray, gelatinous appendages grasping and clawing at her. And then one more. A woman who attempted suicide felt her body sliding downward in a cold, dark, watery environment. When she reached the bottom, it resembled the entrance to a cave with what looked like webs hanging. She heard cries, wails, moans, and gnashing of teeth. She saw beings that resembled humans, but were shaped ugly and grotesque. And they were frightening and sounds of tormented and in agony.
So there's some element of
unpleasant
seeing what we expect to see, what we've been conditioned to see.
Yeah.
We can talk about like, you know, how that manifests in terms of like, I mean, psychology, we could talk about in terms of anxiety, depression, whatever, like seeing what almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I'm wondering like what comes first here? Like these NDEs where we see either visions of heaven where you think you've lived an okay life and you expect to go to heaven, and so you kind of do. And then there's, you know, maybe like a suicide, like you mentioned, and an atheist professor, where on some level they've noticed in society that it's sort of common theme that would be something that might grant you passage to hell. And so when you die or when you perceive death, you see yourself go there. Now, do you think
if they're doing decades-long studies, I would think that that information would have been collected, because that seems like a really basic thought. What was your beliefs before you nearly died?
Well, right? It's not even like, but you can answer that question. Maybe, but you know, we like tell each other, ourselves lies all the time. We don't know what's at the core of your beliefs. So at the core of culture, if I say to you, Dave, if you say to anybody across the planet, for the most part, there'll be some answer that sort of aligns with where do you go when you die? People are going to say some variation of heaven or hell. I think that's basically it. Or nothing. Right? So, but heaven or hell, they're in your mind. They're in the consciousness. And so I think that that's got to be part of it.
So, Greg, there's a few different ways that people respond to distressing near-death experiences. And I thought these were interesting, and I figured you'd probably have some input on these or just some thoughts about them. So the first one is the obvious one, which is the one I'm sure you would draw a conclusion of. It's called the turnaround, or I needed that. So basically it's interpreted as like the near-death experience is interpreted as a warning about the person's behavior in their life and the need to turn one's life around, or this is like how you're going to end up or something, right? That, like, you know, that would probably be our most obvious conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. You would assume that people would respond that way. Another type of response that was called reductionism, like the person kind of minimizes the experience. So it's like a defense that allows one to kind of subscribe it to something else, something other than like okay. that it actually had meaning, or treat it like it didn't matter.
Intellectualizing, almost like a defense mechanism.
Yes. So what they do though is like they're able to, you know, avoid it in a way, or like kind of put it to the side and feel like, oh, I'm past it, but they never actually do get past it. And a lot of times it ends up causing more longer term issues, like anxiety and, you know, other residual negative emotions because they've never processed it. So that's obviously not a great way to go about it. The last one is called the long haul, aka what did I do? And this is for people who are just like haunted by their near-death experience. They're constantly kind of searching for like some kind of explanation. What did I do to deserve this? What are the rules? If the rules I lived by don't work, like they're just, it's an existential crisis.
Yeah.
Essentially.
It's funny that you brought up blind faith earlier. Like, do you think that for anybody, this creates blind faith? Like, say you went to heaven and for all, you know, as far as you know, you were are sure you went to heaven and you come back. Like, how long is it until
you make
yourself believe that you didn't do that? You know, it's like when someone dies in your life.
I think the first types of people, the people who have the turnaround response, I think they get blind faith. I think that they leave there saying, okay, now I see clearly the error of my ways. I know how to move forward. I will do so accordingly. The long haul people, I actually think it's the opposite. I've been living my life in such a way and it didn't have an impact. I ended up getting pulled apart by gelatinous arms in the fiery pits of hell. So the rules I was following don't add up. And now I'm questioning life.
It almost makes me worry, though, because, you know, when someone dies, and unfortunately, like we've had that in your life, like you think that you're going to have, all of a sudden, you're going to have this new perspective where you're like, all right, well, now I'm going to start behaving differently. Life's so short. I'm going to start really paying attention to what's important. And then as time goes by, you sort of go back into your ways. Like, I wonder if this happens a lot with this, too. Like, we lose perspective, or is this such a profound experience that it sticks with us?
Actually, in many of these reports, the distressing ones seem to stick with people. Okay. There was a report of one guy like 30 or 40 years later, he's still haunted by it.
Did he change his life for the better, kind of thing?
Just haunted.
Okay.
His life's haunted.
Okay. Haunted life. Man, that's tough.
I don't know, Greg. So it's interesting. Now, I said earlier that like, oh, there was something I kind of want to get into. And I'll make this quick, because I know we have obviously our topics that we're trying to hit here. But I did get a little bit of information in my research because I was curious. Like, all right, obviously there's spirituality and there's religion aspects in this. But for the people who don't ascribe to that stuff, what about the brain? And I already see Greg's like, yeah, right. The brain.
What about the brain?
Come on, Dave. Come on. So image studies on cardiac patients who have survived near-death experiences have shown that in the gray and white matter, you know, there's the brain activity that is responding during those moments. They reveal that there's common areas involved, such as, you don't like when I use all the brain jargon, but one of the big ones I did want to bring up is like the hippocampus.
Yep.
The amygdala.
Memory, emotion,
frontal lobe, the temporal, the basal ganglia, you know,
all that good stuff
always. The reason why I bring up the hippocampus though, I can't like say this was only my thought, 'cause I was listening to someone speak about like the idea of reliving life events. And when we think about the hippocampus, that's where memories are stored, right? Emotional memory, especially. So like those really impactful moments, you would think if a near-death experience is triggering active responses in the brain, and the hippocampus is one of them, it would make sense to, you know, like relive certain moments, because the hippocampus is kind of like, maybe it's acting in overdrive. Maybe it's, I don't know. I don't know exactly how it operates during those experiences, but it kind of makes sense that maybe we would be reliving some of our past moments, good and bad, because of that brain activity that's happening. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it might make sense in terms of like your brain, its main function is to survive and to organize. So maybe it's like, I'm not connected to the heart. I'm failing. So maybe it's almost like going through a Rolodex to be like, all right, where am I at? Let me go through all these moments in life. Like, where are we at right now? And trying to find it. And you're somehow processing that, remembering it and visualizing it. I don't know. It's kind of a reach, because it just seems like when people have these experiences, it's very put together. Like it's they're behaving and acting as if they have control, or maybe they're just perceiving it that way. And it is sort of just a dream. And I don't know.
Out of body experiences are primarily associated with the right posterior temporal lobe and the temporal part parietal region. I sound dumb. But anyways, so there might be some brain activity explanations for some of the experiences that can happen during near-death experiences. I just thought like I would bring that up. Obviously, I'm not a brain expert, but it would be awesome if we had one on here to tell us.
Yeah, no, it would. I mean, but could they even, is there such a thing as a brain expert? That's the real question, because not really. I mean, we don't even know what the friggin', you know, psychopharmacology, like, we don't even know what the pills do, where they're doing it. I mean, yeah. There is no brain experts. We're all kind of just trying our best.
The thing that does actually like go more towards your argument about near-death experiences, or kind of like, you know, the picture you're trying to paint, is that there's studies of people who have had complete loss of brain function yet still report near-death experiences.
Yeah,
so which even is when the brain is completely not functioning, so there's no stimulation coming from the hippocampus and all the other regions, they're still having the near-death experience.
So, and that's when we came back to what we were saying in the beginning. Like you then in that case, you were thinking and without your brain.
Who was thinking?
That's right. Like that essence, you're separated from your body, which is a brain, is your part of your body. And like
your soul.
It makes a case for the soul, Dave. I know you're saying that in a facetious way.
No, I wasn't. I didn't even smile.
It's your soul, right? Maybe. Your consciousness.
Yeah, maybe
I don't know.
Maybe it is.
I wanted to talk about a few like little pop culture-y things before we get back into some of the final thoughts.
Pop and lock them, dude.
Have you read? Well, there's this book, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. I recommend it very highly. It's here's a great quote from it. The world is full of stories, but the stories are all one. It's just this interconnectedness and meaning and how everything in your life is significant. And how important forgiveness is, and how, you know, there's a reason for everything that happens. There is, like, it's not just arbitrary. Like, life, every little thing you do is important. And love never dies. Like, we die, but, and when I say love never dies, no other pop culture film brings that to life. Like, What Dreams May Come. Have you seen that movie?
I've seen that 1,000 times.
Oh,
I was obsessed with it for a little while, and I don't really know why, but I literally watched it on repeat for quite a while.
It's got all the elements, Dave. It's got depression.
Yeah.
Which we, and like such a deep, dark depression that you would never be able to pull yourself out of, but someone has to act on your behalf to pull you out of it. Isn't that sort of like what we're all about?
Yeah.
So maybe, you know,
it's a really beautiful movie.
It really is. Visually stunning, as they would say.
Yeah.
Flatliners. Great one, right?
Yep.
Here's one that I bet. Well, actually, you know what? You're way more into the movie scene than I am. I mean, you know all the movies, but here's something I came across: The Seventh Seal, and it's this movie based on the philosophy of Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Sartre. And that's all kind of mixed into a story about a medieval knight during the plague playing chess with death.
Interesting.
Sounds
mad boring.
It sounds pretty boring, but no, it's not boring. Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
That's a great, you know, afterlife movie. Sixth Sense.
Yes.
And, you know, that's kind of all we need for pop culture. I told you about my sister. Let me tell you real quick about my dad.
Okay.
Because when he was 12 years old, this is true. He didn't have all the, my dad's super religious still, but he had a near-death experience where he had, what is that thing in your stomach? Like your appendix burst in his stomach. Okay. And it was, you know, this was back in a time where, you know, toughness is very important in our family. And then, you know, I've talked to you about that before, but you can imagine how that was for my dad and his dad, like up, like level that up one. And, you know, it was this thing where like, you better be almost dead if you're going to be missing school. And it turns out my dad was like, he was walking to school and he just collapsed because his stomach hurt so bad. And it was his appendix and it burst. And so they took him to the hospital and he was septic and there was, you know, they tried an operation on him and then he woke up and then it was all green stuff in his hands. And he's like, this can't be right. And the nurse was like, oh my God, that's all he remembers. And then when he came to, or before he came to, he remembers seeing them working on him. He remembers that to this day. He remembers that. And when he woke up, he had white hair. Not all white, but he had a lot of white hair. And this is, Dave, you're laughing? His nickname, like my cousins call him Uncle White. Because since 12 years old, the guy had white hair because of this traumatic experience.
Really?
I mean, also, there's this other element to it. Like, when in pop culture, it was reminding me of like It, where that guy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Yep. He saw an entity and his hair turned white because like he wasn't like ready for it. I don't know what it is, but yeah. This that could have happened to my dad in a sense. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
It is, right?
It's, and that's
so, you know, my dad, well, look, put it this way. For him, it's true, right?
Yes, yes.
So, and
I'm going to let him have it.
I am going to let him have it. So let's talk a little bit about like how this compares to a psychedelic experience. Like what is it? Like, it's very different, isn't it? It's sort of,
is it different than all of your psychedelic experiences?
Yeah,
all the times you've taken
well, I mean, I might have had one or two, but
how about the times you took mushrooms?
We didn't do it.
Is it different than okay. That?
Yeah. So no mushrooms. No thanks. But obviously, Dave, you know we're gonna have to do it and just report on it. That way we can that one bad review, we can get that back. I don't think it compares at all to a psychedelic experience, even though I guess I can't really speak to that. But it seems like this is more universal and a psychedelic experience is more individual. So this is connecting to something bigger than us, I think.
Yeah.
I just think it's more evidence towards that.
Yeah.
And maybe like there's this guy, this researcher, Dr. Long, right? And for him, is that a defense mechanism? Does he need to believe that it's true because he's getting older, closer to death? Like, is he trying so hard to prove this? So that
this is like his thing. It's like his thing too. So like he has to like really, you know, champion it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He can't just suddenly be like, you know what, guys, I'm kind of like a little iffy on this topic now.
You know what? His work might be useful though, honestly. Like if he comes, you know, science tells us that if you can prove something over and over again, or if something happens repeatedly, whatever, it's like almost, it's true, right? Isn't that how you test things? So this must be able to bring comfort to patients in hospice settings, right? Hey, look, at least like this is consistently observed. So there's a chance this is real. We're going to show you this so you can kind of pass away knowing that maybe there's some hope. You're instilling hope before they die. Yeah. And if there's nothing, well, no harm, no foul. But if there's, you know, I mean, it's just something to make.
Or they feel deceived and tricked.
They're not gonna feel shit if there's nothing, right? They're not gonna feel a damn thing.
Go ahead.
I want to ask you, like, do you believe that there's life after death?
I'm not gonna answer that.
You don't know.
So I don't know. I think it's interesting to think though, like you're saying, like how this person could potentially, you know, make individuals in hospice care feel comforted. yes and no. Like, it really does depend on the individual. And I feel like some people just aren't ready, right? Like, some people maybe feel like they have unfinished business. Some people feel scared by the thought of it. The unknown is scary, 100%.
Yeah.
And some people are able to believe in something to help them, you know, feel more comfort with that. And if they don't have any unfinished business or anything, like any loose ties, then they're more at ease than others. And there's others who I just feel like aren't ready to believe in that, or to believe that there could be something comforting, or even if that's comfort is nothing at all, that that's okay. And like, I don't know. I feel like it could be helpful to people who are okay, who need to hear it. But to others, I don't know that there's always going to be comfort, because I just feel like everybody's at a different place. There's this thing that like we see all the time. It's like, you have to like just understand not everybody is in the same place. Not everybody's going to ever be able to be in the same place. There are some people.
What would comfort me? Why not comfort somebody else?
100%. And yeah, maybe who's to say that you ever could be comforted, because maybe there's something really preventing you from being comforted. Maybe there's something really deep seated in like someone's conscious that makes them think that like I don't deserve. And so it won't happen that that my afterlife will be euphoric. Right. Maybe I'm not a good person. Imagine that. Who thinks that they're a bad person, how would they believe that like my afterlife could be good?
I don't know. I think it would be, would that be wrong? It would be still, dude. So this is what we were talking about. Is there such thing as a good dark psychology? And would it be wrong to kind of convince that person that there is something and you do deserve to be there? And I don't know. Providing some meaning at the end of someone's life, I think that's can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I'm not talking about you as the person providing. I'm talking about the person themselves. Like how?
Yeah, no, I know.
How do they start to like truly understand? Like it, you know. Like I think religion is good and bad, because it like it's good because it provides people comfort in times that are like this. Like this, it can be harmful or bad because it does kind of tell people they're bad people at times, right?
Yeah.
And if you really truly believe you're a bad person, I would find it really hard to believe that it's easy to find comfort or persuade yourself otherwise.
So I think that what's going on here is we're having a conversation about, and this, it's not just belief and non-belief. It's like logic versus emotion, mm-hmm. I think. So, you know, if you ask someone if they believe in God, a lot of times they'll say, you know, if everything's going well and you ask them in like, during the day and it's bright and sunny, they might say no. But if you ask them when they're terrified and something really dangerous is going to happen, or they really need something, they might say, yeah. So it's like, there's, you know, do you believe God only when I need him and when I'm scared or something like that? I don't know. There is something like, and which one's true? Like, are you more in touch with truth when you're at a high emotional state, or are you more in touch with truth when you're at a logical state? Because it's hard to know. It's hard to know which one is where the truth lies. Like if I told you, Dave, that when I got home from work today, there was a working, up and running farm where my house used to be, you wouldn't believe me. Like if we were just at work together, you wouldn't believe that happened like that. That happened so fast. But if I told you, hey, my grandfather passed away and I could have sworn I saw a little orb floating around after he passed, you would be more likely to believe something like that. And one's based in complete fact, like someone could knock down my house and start growing things there. And the other one's based completely on emotion. And somehow that story is more believable. I don't know. Yeah. There's blurred lines here. And I don't think that we got any closer to getting to the bottom of it.
Well, another like really challenging thing to think about is we're in a clinical setting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting with someone who maybe had a near-death experience and we're helping them process what happened. It is not our practice to typically talk in the terms of religious beliefs. However, that comes up really heavily in these conversations. So it's a really interesting thing, because we have to take our clinical beliefs and somehow make them not conflict with the individual's religious beliefs, which we would never do normally either. Like if someone had religious beliefs and it came up in, you know, in therapy, obviously whatever they believe, you know, was, we're going to be non-judgmental and we're going to try to emphasize helping them process things through their beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say that would be the same in this, but like so much of this is so heavily embedded in religious beliefs and interpretations, right? That it sometimes could conflict with clinic. Like I could provide actual like clinical information like I was doing with the brain, and that person might be like, no, that's not what that is. And I'm like, oh, okay.
And then, you know, sometimes I think it's useful though. Like when people are spiritual, sometimes that's an asset in therapy.
Oh, it, I think it's almost always an asset.
Yeah.
Some belief system, right?
Yeah. Something to provide meaning, a purpose, like hope, you know, it's nice. It's sometimes it's hard when there isn't that. I don't know, Dave, what do you think? Like, I think it's an interesting topic. I think that maybe if we generate some interest in this, then we've done our job here today.
Well, the thing that makes this topic impossible to actually make any headway in is...
You could have died to find out.
Yeah, there's no... I mean, there's been... People have been having near-death experiences for all of mankind, and there's still no exact science on this. So, I mean, it is only that. It is just a talking point, right? With with some science information and a bunch of spiritual and religious information.
And not one is more valid than the other.
No, and that's what I was going to say, just to kind of like, and that thing about like the clinical versus religious beliefs, the whole like response that we have to have in that kind of setting is always to just be non-judgmental and always take that approach. And who's to say that my theory is more accurate than your theory? And I kind of believe that even in our conversation today, like, you know, I'm teasing you a little bit, but like, I have no explanation. You certainly don't have an explanation, but my explanation is no more accurate than yours.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Just
like, well, agree. Once again, agree to disagree, which is nice.
You think yours is more accurate?
And you know, so there's a huge collection of data, but then as I'm saying that, I'm like, I think there's like 5,000 in this website, and that's a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, not that much. Though?
Yeah, it's really
nice. Yeah. So I mean, I don't know. I think that I don't know. I guess I don't know. I'm in the same spot, and I think that's fun. We could just talk in circles about it if we wanted to.
Yeah.
But we won't do that.
No.
We'll avoid David, thank you for showing up to this and, you know, putting our best foot forward and putting a face on and doing it. And
I mean, it is sort of a challenging talking point because you don't want to just sit here and say the obvious. So we have to find angles and we have to find somewhat like different talking points than what everybody would expect we're going to talk about. Like, obviously people expect, we say the topic is near-death experiences. Everyone thinks we're going to talk about like outer body experience and
see a lot. And we did.
But there's more to it than that. And hopefully we shed some light into the other aspects as well.
Oh yeah. I
really wasn't familiar with the distressing near-death experiences, as like, I didn't know that they were actually like a whole category of them. So that's,
no, my sister and I had saw an episode of Unsolved Mysteries when we were young, and there was a guy who kind of went to hell. You remember that show, right? That they would always have some kind of
theme music creeped me out so much as a kid.
Oh man, that was tough to go to bed after watching that.
So
this was good. Thanks, Dave.
Well, to everybody that, you know, has reached out to us in private, in DMs and stuff like that, or on social media, email, we appreciate you. Thank you so much for doing so. But also, please, if you guys have the opportunity, we would love to hear you offer some feedback on a public forum for other people to be able to see. But also, as I mentioned in most episodes, leaving ratings and reviews is a great way to help an algorithm boost, I guess, and our access gets to a more wider audience, which we would love, so we can continue to grow the show. So if you are open to doing so, we would be forever grateful. We will definitely read the review on our next episode. And and then also we have a subscriptions page. We just you know, you can sign up, you can give a monthly donation. We will give you a shout out. We will end up doing some merch at some point when we collect up some funds to do so. And we just, you know, appreciate that level of support. You can find that subscriptions page on our Instagram account in the links. And every now and then I put it up on social media, like X.
And that was Jacqueline that sent us some great messages about some, you know, requesting some topics, which we also love.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. And yeah, so that's the other thing. We got this laundry list of topics that are coming up. We keep adding to it just in our own thoughts, but then we get influences from listeners, which is awesome. So we started to kind of actually plan out for once the upcoming weeks versus like after an episode being, hey, what do you want to do next week? So we got a pretty good amount of topics already. We'd love to keep adding to that list just so we can keep this going pretty much forever. But yeah, thank you everyone for listening and just being supportive and being awesome. And we'll be back next week.
Yeah, we will.
Oh, next week, St. Patrick's Day episode. So
yeah.
Bring out your shillelaghs.
Shillelaghs and shenanigans.
And shenanigans.
Yeah. And shamrocks.
Shakes.
That's it. Here we go. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Have a great night. We will see you next week.